Views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
Get fired up for Spirit Fire Radio, your guide to practical mindfulness and meditation. Join hosts Tim Darter and Steve Kramer and discover how to add the mechanics of meditation to your day. Watch yourself connecting in a whole new way and find the amazing moments in life's routines that often pass us by. Add to your awareness with Spirit Fire Radio. Now here's your hosts, Tim Darter and Steve Kramer.
Hello and welcome to Spirit Fire Radio. I'm Steve Kramer.
And I'm Tim Darter.
It is great to be with you today and so great to be inviting back a very special guest who we've had twice on our show already, Dr. Dorothy Riddle. Dorothy, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Well, before we talk about the meditation practice, which we always sort of start out talking about the step of the practice that we're on here at Spirit Fire Radio, I just want to let the listeners know that we have been covering Dorothy's wonderful series, which is called Enough for Us All. It's a volume, three-volume set of books, and we very interestingly started with the last of the three volumes many weeks ago with step number two, which was tip of the nose. We talked about noticing the usually not noticed in another as a way to see ourselves in somebody and try to get rid of a bit of that us versus them mentality that we know has just been so prevalent lately. And it's a wonderful step within the practice, and it's a wonderful reminder to us all that these tools work in our everyday world. And then we talked about the mind, and we talked about positive harmlessness in practice. This is volume two of Dorothy Riddle's series. And we talked about the mind and ways the mind contracts and the ways the mind expands and ways to expand into positivity, into harmlessness, into a way of really living together that feels good for us all. And now we are nearing the end of the round of the practice. We're actually on step 13, which is the central channel. And interestingly enough, we are on now, as we approach the end of our series, we're at the beginning of Dorothy's series, the first book of this series called Principles of Abundance for the Cosmic Citizen. Wonderful, amazing book. And I know this is just going to be a rich conversation, as all of our conversations with Dorothy have been. So, you know, Principles of Abundance for the Cosmic Citizen. I love that we have sort of saved this for last as we talk about the central channel. The central channel is energy that moves up and down our spine, constantly connecting us to all that is. It is this sort of energetic abundance. It shows us all that we are. And so as we near the end of the round of meditation, we sort of get to tune in with all of these tools, this amazing tool belt that we've got that taps us into awareness and realize that we are awareness. We have constant access to all that is awareness and to what we create in our own awareness. From Ground of Being, last couple of shows ago, we talked about The Compassion of Vincent Van Gogh. What an amazing show, talking about ways that we can embody all that we've learned. And then when we put that embodiment out in the world through a toroidal flow, we become all that. We have access to all that through the central channel. So we're just going to get started and just talk about this book, Principles of Abundance for the Cosmic Citizen. Dorothy, I should tell our listeners, you know, I think they know you by now, but perhaps we have listeners who aren't quite familiar. So Dorothy, you have taught in more than 75 countries. You are an author. You are on the board of the School for Esoteric Studies, which we are going to talk about quite a bit today, I hope. Enoughforusall.com is a website that that talks about these principles, talks about these volumes of books and all that they offer. You've done workshops, lectures. You have really done so much in the way of social justice and welcome. Is there anything more we could say?
I think that certainly gets us started, Steve. Thank you.
Okay. You know, that just came from the top of my head. I'm pretty impressed with myself. Abundance. It is a word, you know, abundance is a word when I think of you and all that I know about all that you've contributed. And I'd love to hear in your words what this word abundance means.
Well, it's a really interesting word and concept, Steve, because it's that feeling of content, that joyous sense that we have everything that we need. In fact, we have more than we need. And what's interesting about it is that there's not a specific definition in that if you have this much, then you have abundance. Because it's very subjective. It's linked to our sense of sufficiency. What is enough? Which is where the title of the whole series came from, Enough for Us All. And so if we believe that that our needs are met and that desires are interesting but don't always have to be met, we can be very content. But we can also have a lot of material goods and not feel abundant if we feel that we haven't got enough. So it's how we define that sense of sufficiency, that sense of enough.
Mm, and we hear that so much in this modern day of sort of materialism. Mm-hmm. You hear so many people that have a lot of sort of, we get to hear them on the media that say, you know, you think I have everything, but yet I'm lonely or I'm unhappy, or that
That's
money
right.
is the end, that the material world is not the end all. We sort of all have that dangling carrot in the sense of being an actual carrot, that, you know, get the carrot and you will be happy, you will be fulfilled. But actually, you know, we need to sort of redesign or sort of redefine and redesign what abundance means and ways in which we sort of welcome that into our psyche. You know, limitation doesn't feel so pretty in our psyche.
Well, we tend to think of limitation as negative, but let me give you two examples. I recently heard an interview with a woman who has just had her ideal home built, and it's 250 square feet. Now, if you think about that in relation to the living space that many of us, including myself, live in, that's very tiny. And in fact, there are conferences now on what are called tiny homes. And when she was interviewed, she said that, you know, she had downsized to 800 square feet, but it just felt too big. It felt like there was excess there that she didn't need. And she said now that she was down to 250, her shopping experience was very different, because she would go, she would see things that were interesting, but she always had to think of, would they fit well within the space that was her space, right? And she feels very positive about living in 250 square feet. But another example I'd like to give, because I think the principle of limitation is misunderstood and it's given a very negative cast. Think about music. If you listen to a piece of music, particularly a piece of classical music that you love, if the composer had simply dumped every single note, every single sound in at the same time, it would make absolutely no sense at all. The beauty of the music is from the constraint, the limitation of choosing only certain notes and only in certain order. Does that make sense?
Yes. Is that as much limitation as it is discernment or discrimination in a way? Discrimination in a positive way?
Yeah.
Or those organization, refinement?
Yeah, I think that those are all linked to this principle of limitation. You know, what is it? I'm just trying to expand the way that we think about that, because the underlying myth that gets us into trouble in the whole area of abundance is the myth of scarcity, that there is not enough. And we use that in our language a lot. We say, oh, you know, I don't have enough time. You know, I don't have enough money, or I don't have. Every time we find ourselves saying that, I would encourage our listeners to stop and say, wait a minute, you know, I have choices about how I'm using my time. I have choices about how I'm using my money. I have choices, and it will feel different. It will feel expansive instead of constrained.
Yes. Well, one thing I find interesting about your story, especially the woman who has now a 250 square foot home, is she came from a place of abundance and realized it was unnecessary. And I love that you said she felt good in this home. So really, certainly the universe was showing her that there's all kinds of abundance. You can have an 800 square foot, you could have an 800,000 square foot home if really that was what you wanted to put your mind to. But do you feel good in that space? And does it really meet your needs? Does it speak to your ground of being? You know, does it speak to you? Do you feel good in that? So, you know, I think you're right in that you said in the last show, you talked about this sort of cloud of thought forms that exists above us, you know, that sort of gets in the way of our light and our truth and actually feeling our truth. And I think that's a bit of it, you know, that if you don't have this much money, then if you don't have this many cars, then if you don't, you know, have this kind of resume, then. And really, you know, we tend to look at what we don't. We can have a tendency instead of what is available to us and then say, well, there's so much abundance, but maybe I don't need all that abundance. So I love that aspect of it.
Right. And one of the challenges in our culture, it began after the Second World War, is this whole in the advertising and marketing realm, the messages around entitlement. You deserve it. You should have it.
Yes.
And all that does is to create unnecessary desire for something that really is not fundamental to your being.
Yeah, and it's somebody else's, you know, certainly that's somebody else's words.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Watch that. Well, I want to get right to the juice of your book because really there is so much to talk about. I was sending lists and lists of talking points and certainly want to really talk about the meat and potatoes of this book, which is in the first word of the title, Principles of Abundance for the Cosmic Citizen. There are a list of principles in this book that are words that we would all, you know, many of them we know well. We would use them, I would say, pretty regularly or understand their meaning. But when you put them in the context of creating a new paradigm for living and you just ask people, consider what life would be like. You may not directly be asking people, but, you know, I always sort of look at this and say, well, all right, if everyone in the world was doing this, what kind of world would this look like and would I feel good in it? And my goodness, it's like a utopia, you know, this kind of. So I'd love for us to go through these principles, if you don't mind. There are the principles that underlie our reality. So what is our reality? You know, we talk about the reality of abundance. You know, we have to define, well, okay, really, what is our reality? And you've got four principles that underlie this reality. And then you've got three principles that govern how we coexist, meaning, you know, our reality is not just our reality. It is our own reality. It is a reality of all of us. And we are a part of the human kingdom. We are a part of this planet Earth. We are a part of this cosmic. We are a part of this solar system and this universe. And we, in order to sort of work with the first four principles, we must understand the second three. So what do you say we go through these, Dorothy? Would that be okay?
Sure. Be happy to.
Wonderful. So the first one is interconnectivity.
Okay.
We are all interconnected energy waves. So you're getting a little scientific there. Like we're all interconnected energy waves.
Well, one of the things I'd like to say just at the very beginning, Steve, for our listeners, is if anybody picks up one of my books, what you'll find is that in the back, so as not to interfere with the narrative, there's a list of all of the science references to support what I'm saying. So these are not just feel-good things that I think. This comes out of science. And in the first section, those first four principles all come from quantum physics, which sounds a little bit scary to some people who are not scientists. But really, quantum physics is about the science of energy and matter. And one of the gifts that it has given us, and by the way, this research started 150 years ago. This is not just brand new stuff, but it hasn't really permeated into the way in which we think about ourselves and our world. And what quantum physics tells us is that nothing is completely predetermined. Everything is waves of energy. And you can have a wave that expresses as a physical particle, but you cannot have a world that is only particles. I mean, that just doesn't exist. The base form is energy, which is interesting because that's what metaphysics has been saying all these years. And now we have it scientifically. And so we are energy forms, and we are entangled with each other. We are, they talk about non-local connectedness. And Steve, if you don't mind, I would just like to read one quote to help our listeners get a sense of what this means. Is that okay?
Dorothy, you can read any quotes from this book you feel inspired to
okay.
read. It, they're lovely. Go on.
This is by Brian Schwimm, the mathematical cosmologist, and he uses the term all-nourishing abyss to describe the cosmic context in which we all live and move and have our being. And this is from his book, The Hidden Heart of the Cosmos. He writes, "The universe emerges out of all-nourishing abyss not only 15 billion years ago, but in every moment. Each instance, protons and antiprotons are flashing out of and are as suddenly absorbed back into all-nourishing abyss. All-nourishing abyss, then, is not a thing or a collection of things, nor even, strictly speaking, a physical place, but rather a power that gives birth and that absorbs existence at a thing's annihilation. The foundational reality of the universe is this unseen ocean of potentiality. If all the individual things of the universe were to evaporate, one would be left with an infinity of pure generative power." Mm. Now, if you really sit with that, isn't that empowering in itself? I mean, isn't that fantastic that we always are immersed in this potentiality? And the thing about the principle of interconnectivity is that it brings with it the responsibility that whatever we do or say or think or feel affects others. So we are not isolated entities. We're not this little physical island by ourselves. We are interconnected, which means we can draw from the universe, but it also means we have to take responsibility for how we participate.
And I love always that word responsibility. I think when you break that combined compound word into two words, responsibility. Do I have the ability to respond? It sheds new light on the word responsibility. What is my responsibility? You know, really, am I responding with the fullness of my abilities here? And we all know when we are feeling centered, when we are in the light of our innermost, and we connect with another individual who is also taking responsibility. Their sense of responsibility is at its fullest. In other words, they are totally connected, and we connect one another. Pure potentiality is right at your fingertips. You know, if you've ever been with another creative individual and you've co-created, it's Tim and I have that all the time. I mean, there's times mm-hmm. we look at some of the things that we're creating and we just think, this is amazing. You know, we sense that magic that's happening. So all of us, I think, understand interconnectivity. We just sometimes have a problem or a snag sort of, as you say, going beyond the physical and realizing that these are universal principles. These are principles that are energetic law, really.
Yes, yes. And that if we move that into the second principle of participation, because it's so intimately linked, this is the principle that we create our own reality. That in a very fundamental way, the universe, you think of the universe as energy, as potentiality. the universe doesn't exist until we observe it and interpret it. So the choices that we make create how we experience the world. And, you know, unfortunately, we have some negative examples of this, you know, where we've had recent violence where the violence occurred because of the person's perception of the context that they were in. You know, shooting an unarmed person when you think that that person is dangerous to them. So that's the participation, the creating the reality, the laying assumptions onto what is actually happening.
Yes, and that not only do we as individuals create our own reality, but you know that we as a subculture, a culture, a country, a species, you know, that really does, as in all of these, you can take it out and out and further and further, and it just, the truth resounds, you know, in these beautiful unfolding waves as I always tap into each one of, every time I tap into one of these principles. Wonderful. So let's move on to two, because these might need a little bit of the last two within these four principles that underlie our reality, which is non-linearity and non-duality. So in our first show, we talk quite a bit about non-duality, you know, that really we're in this together, and that as you say in the book, our reality is complex and non-dualistic. So non-linearity, you know, this is saying that our experience is fundamentally non-linear. That one, yeah. I think, is one people might hit a bit of we think of time. You know, I wake up in the morning and there's my day laid out in front of me, and I do the same thing tomorrow. I'm this age because I'm no longer that age.
Yeah. Well, we use time to try to make sense of our experience. And so we are used to thinking along a linear time sequence. The scientists talk about a space-time continuum, which puts it more into four dimensions. But there are two things that I think can help us. One is, think about your own experience of time. And if you spend a little bit of, take a little bit of thought, I think you'll realize that time is not your experience of time is not these equal units. You know, if you're preparing for something, you may feel like time just goes by so fast, you know, you can hardly get there. If you're waiting for someone to arrive that you are really looking forward to being with, sometimes it can feel like the time just drags on, you know, it's taking forever for it to happen. So we have that subjective sense of time. Another perspective is, think about going out at nighttime and looking up into the night sky, and you see those stars up there. You're not looking at present time. You may think you are. You're looking at the distant past. Some of those stars may not exist now. That's just the light coming through, you know, the centuries towards us. So there is a sense in which time exists, but the reality is that it's much more malleable than we think it is. I'm sorry, go ahead.
It seems as if it's just a reference point. You know, that's what you said. It seems to be a reference. It seems to be a point of departure or it seems where we can sort of find our place within using time as a backdrop. It seems to give us a grid in a way. Yeah. So I appreciate that. You know, that you said time feels so slow mm-hmm. when you're waiting for someone to arrive. You realize, well, it's not if we shift from this linear way of looking at the world to it's really about our experience and the choices we make and the choices we how do we relate to a situation? How do we relate to our place within that situation and using our emotions as a sort of a guidance system with that, mm-hmm. you realize that it is just about creating your reality. And that mm-hmm. time is there just as a tool almost. So I can really appreciate that.
Yeah, and we have to be careful to remember that it's a tool because, for example, one of the ways that we distort who we are and what's important is we create certain frameworks for history. Like we label history by periods of war, for example.
Mm.
Well, that puts the focus on violence. We don't
right.
have to choose that as the frame of reference. There's also the issue that you can change things in the past. And there's actually quantum physics experiments on this, but I'll give you a personal example.
Dorothy, I hate to interrupt, but I want to get into this. I love the idea of how do we, this space-time continuum and changing the past. Everybody loves to hear about that. We need to go to a break, though. This has been just
okay.
So easy. We're going to go to a break, and right when we come back, we're going to talk about that, the past and its relationship to quantum physics. I can't wait. We'll be right back.
Brand consultant and coach Jen Morgan is here with Radically Distinct Radio to help maximize your brand's power to produce results. Whether you're a person with a dream and unsure where to start, or a CEO of a successful company wondering what's next, Jen Morgan and the RAD method empowers you to play to your strengths and focus your competitive edge so you can show up in the world as your most powerful brand. Go to jenmorgan.com or call 206-972-5366.
Artie Hoffman is the hottest psychic with the warmest heart and the host of the hit show Angels and Answers. A renowned psychic, medium, spiritual life coach, and an entertaining motivational speaker, Artie has helped over 15,000 people with his amazing intuitive gifts, his passion, and his humor. Call 877-ANGEL-02 to schedule a personal reading or to have your own psychic Artie party. That's 877-ANGEL-02. And visit ArtieHoffman.com and Angels and Answers on Facebook.
Hi, I'm Tim Darter.
And I'm Steve Kramer.
Join us on Spirit Fire Radio. Discover how to add the mechanics of meditation to your day.
And watch yourself connect in a whole new way. Find the amazing moments in life's routines that often pass us by. Add to your awareness with Spirit Fire Radio.
Tune in each Wednesday at 9 a.m. for your weekly guide to practical mindfulness. And to learn more, visit www.spiritfireradio.com.
Get into it for 2016. Do you want more prosperity, clarity, energy, and balance in your life? Join Lynn Brown now for one of her amazing workshops, each focusing on a key part of living your best life. For more information and to register for one of these amazing workshops, visit lynnbrownevent.com. That's lynnbrownevent.com. And get into it this 2016 with Lynn Brown.
Are you ready for a game changer? Sarah Westall is bringing you Business Game Changers Radio. Sarah brings you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. Tune in to Business Game Changers Mondays at noon Pacific, 3 Eastern on TransformationTalkRadio.com.
Hi, this is Leslie Fontaine, and my show is Sheer Alchemy on TransformationTalkRadio.com. When we're bogged down with our emotions, the hardships that plague us in our relationships, at work, our finances, we literally can't see the higher plane where we could be operating from. Tune in to Leslie Fontaine, Sheer Alchemy on TransformationTalkRadio.com.
Welcome back to Spirit Fire Radio. We are having such a wonderful discussion with Dr. Dorothy Riddle. She is the author of a 3-volume set that goes under the umbrella title of Enough for Us All. You can find out about these books at enoughforusall.com. We have dedicated 3 shows to this amazing work. The first show, Moving Beyond Duality. The second, Positive harmlessness in practice. And today we are talking about quantum physics. We're talking about abundance, about principles of our existence. This is her first book, Principles of Abundance for the Cosmic Citizen. I love being a citizen of the cosmos, and I can't wait to cooperate even more as a cooperative citizen as our conversation continues. So before we left off, we were really about to dive into quantum physics. I'm glad we got to take a break and I got to take a deep breath, because we're talking about non-linearity. And if you could just pick up where we left off, we were talking about time.
Sure. So one of the things that the quantum physics experiments have shown us, and these are experiments that have gone on over quite a number of years, is that how you observe or how you act or the choice that you make in the present actually can go back and change the past. And I was going to give a personal example of this. When I was growing up, my father became, when I was about five, we were living in India, my father became very ill with jaundice. I mean, he was close to dying. And we were up in the Himalayan mountains, and I was, you know, active. I wanted to be in school, and I really pushed. And the doctors were saying that he needed to go to a specialized hospital quite a distance away. So I lobbied to go into boarding. And I went into boarding at the age of five. And I got a lot of messages from other people that I was being deserted by my parents, I was too young, all of that kind of thing. So when I reunited with my family at the school holiday, I was carrying all that with me. And my mother and I just did not connect. I mean, I was very critical of her. And we had years and years, very painful years, of not getting along and distance. And then one day, when I was 27, I remember sitting in the living room, her living room. I remember the sun coming in the window. And I suddenly, for some reason, realized that at that moment, I was older than she had been when she had three small children in the Himalayan mountains, a husband that was probably dying, and this five-year-old saying, I want to go into boarding, I want to go into boarding. And I realized that she was caught in a very difficult situation. And suddenly my feeling about it completely shifted. I literally, from that day to now, cannot reengage with the feeling that I had had before that was so critical of her. And it was an excellent example for me of how you actually literally can heal the past.
Right. And so time was necessary as a framework for you to look back and compare. You know, it allows us to sort of take a look at this grid and say, well, I am here. This is where she was. This is where I've been. This is where I have come. And this is where from here on out, I believe I will go. And so it's their markers. They're quite literally markers. But time hasn't really changed. Huh?
Well, there is a sense, and this is a science that, I mean, I'm not a quantum physicist, but there is a sense in which things are happening simultaneously. There is a perspective from that. It's like us, Steve, I don't think it's helpful for us to go there, actually, because that's, we're not set up to, you know, we need some framework to anchor our experience on. And one of the frameworks, one of the rules, here's a way of thinking of it. One of the rules of this particular planet, Earth, is that we have a past, present, and future framework that we use for thinking about things.
Exactly. Yes.
So I think in terms of time,
we can leave that principle. Limited, right? No, we do, because we have prescribed this amount of time to the radio show. You know, I would just say that without taking up too much time, I had a similar experience with that. My mom was very ill as I was growing up, and I always felt I was there for her as much as I could be. I was supportive. I lived in New York City. She only lived 3 hours away. As her illness progressed, I was home as much as I could be. I was, as far as I was best concerned being the dutiful son. At a moment, I had a heart-opening moment where I realized my mom needed love. There was more than time. It was about love. And all of a sudden, the time in which I spent with her, which could just be an hour as opposed to the 4 days that I was there, because I had this sort of revelation and an awakening of the power of the love that I was had the capacity to give to her, to share to her with her, and to receive from her, time then meant really nothing. And I sort of would use my sort of, I was home for 4 days, that was wonderful. But really, I could see her for an hour from there on. And the time we spent together shifted our, changed our reality from that moment on. So, you know, when we put, when we sort of go beyond just measuring ourselves or our accomplishments or our sort of relationships by time, things really open up, you know. So interdependence. Let's move on to principles that govern how we coexist, because I would have to say that these are three beautiful words: interdependence, adaptability, and cooperation. Beautiful, amazing words. Very Darwinian, I must say.
Well, maybe in terms of Darwin has been perhaps misinterpreted. We'll come back to that when we talk about adaptability. But in terms of interdependence, this is about recognizing that we, again, getting back to the fact that we're all part of the same energy field, that we don't exist separately from others, that what we do affects them, and we need them also. And we need to be valuing other life forms. We can't exist without those other life forms. And so we have a very anthropocentric view of the world. This may be a term some people aren't familiar with, but that's assuming that humans are at the center of everything. But in fact, we're only one of the life forms that makes up this particular Earth, and this particular Earth is just one small planet in a very large system of thousands and thousands and thousands of galaxies and metagalaxies. So recognizing that we are interdependent, and the term that I want to put out there, and this is again from Brian Schwinn, is instead of thinking of other life forms as resources, think of them as relatives.
Ah.
So you can use that also with people, of course, because we are actually all related to each other at some level. But if you also go through your world and you look at the tree, you look at animals that you interact with, the earth itself, and think of them as relatives of yours, it does shift the way in which you think about acting.
Yes. I would add that when we look at all of these words, and perhaps I should save this TM to the end, but I won't. You know, it's asking for a real paradigm shift. You know, when I read through all of these and hear your explanations, I think, why is this not taught to kids? Why is this not a class that you receive on some level in third grade when you start to understand, hey, I need to participate. We're all connected. Like, you know, it's not about the end of class. Let's not just look at the clock and think, well, in 40 minutes, class is going to be over. So much can happen in this 1 minute, you know, that came out of nowhere that will change, you know, the way you see the rest of the class time. Or, you know, we're in this together. All of these principles could be taught to children and then expanded upon when you're, you know, in sixth grade, when you're in, I can just see how is learning physics then, learning biology, even world religion, learning art. You could take these seven principles and you could, this could be an education for a child for 12 straight years of our, at least American educational process. Mm-hmm. My goodness, with that framework, you would come out. Would you come out a cosmic citizen? You'd certainly be that much closer to it.
Well, if we could interweave the themes around cosmic citizenship into these last three principles, certainly, because it is about how we coexist. And the the basic concept I'd like people to think about is we talk about having a genetic heritage, but we have an energetic heritage also, and that's again one of the gifts from quantum physics is that we are all energetically connected, and that means that we are linked to every bit of energy in this world. And what's interesting in terms of what you were saying, Steve, is that in 1944, there was a Declaration of Interdependence that was written in the United States. And it was read into the U.S. Congressional Record in 1949.
Wow.
And I have to say, as someone who was schooled at least part of the time in the United States, as a young person, I never heard about it.
Yeah, because we love the independence. We love, you know, the Declaration of Independence.
That's right.
But you also have a Declaration of Interdependence. That's evolution.
Right.
And interestingly enough, that it came around at the same time as, you know, you say really there was a paradigm shift after World War II. You think of the Bill of Rights, you know, within the United Nations and all of these documents that are really trying to just put a stamp on saying this is fact, this is law. We are here together and we better figure this out.
Mm-hmm.
So adaptability, let's move on because those are, you know, I'd love to get through these. Adaptability and cooperation.
Yeah, let's talk about those together because the research for this comes out of the life sciences and particularly the work of the biologist Lynn Margulis. And she has some fascinating writing, if anybody's interested in reading this kind of thing, about how microbes are the most plentiful of the species on our Earth, and they choose to combine and go together. This also gets back to the interdependence. They know that they can do more things, they can be more effective if they group together. And we are ourselves the result of that, of all of these microbes getting together and cooperating with each other. And she has lots of research to illustrate that networking and cooperation is actually our basic modality. But what she says,
Can we just like put underscore that when you say we are because of that, we are the result that biologically we would literally not be here on this planet if it weren't for that on that intelligence on some level that cooperation works. We wouldn't be here.
That's right.
Or at least
we wouldn't have
this human body in which our souls can inhabit to express if we want to go there. You know, we wouldn't have this. Amazing.
That's right. And she takes issue with the way in which Darwin has been interpreted. And I put it that way because it's not clear that this is what Darwin actually meant in terms of the survival of the fittest, you know, being the model. And what she says is that actually the way in which we adapt, the way in which we change most frequently, not all, but most frequently, is because bacteria, these little microbes, have access to a single global genetic pool, and they recombine, and they can make a change actually quite rapidly. So the kind of genetic mutation that we're used to from the Darwinian theory is only one way, and it's not the most common way in which change comes about.
Right. It's so, just lens, actually, right? This word fittest as opposed to cooperation. You know, fittest really means I am the fittest and you are not. And that then comes down to
dualistic.
Totally, us versus them. And also competition. You know, you talk about competition. I hope I'm not taking this in a direction you didn't want to go. But
no,
competition is really a big part of this book. And it's something we all know and feel. And something I personally, let me tell you, when I was a kid, my brother was the state wrestling champion. He was a valedictorian. He was the best of the best of the best. And much of that was about competition. He thrives on competition. He's a great guy, huge heart. But, you know, I never enjoyed sports because I couldn't – even going to his meets because – that screaming at each other, it always – us versus them always comes down to screaming is what I came to. So it's like screaming.
Yeah, and I would agree. There's a role for competition, but it is not our base way of relating because competition in and of itself does not make us more trusting. It does not make us more inclusive. it generally creates the opposite. And so what competition plays a very important role in self-improvement. We compete with ourselves. We say, can I do it better? Or, you know, we go into a sport and we push ourselves. It's nice to have a comparison point, and it functions well as a comparison point.
But
it doesn't function well when it is set up as opposed to failure, right? Because that generates a lot of very negative energy.
Which means we just need to always be reminded to take the macro. You know, we just need to be reminded to observe and move out and see that we are a part of something bigger. You know, in all of that competition, if you can just say, I am a part of really human potentiality. What is possible here? And I thank you as my competitor for allowing me to push myself to become all that I can be. Well, hooray. You know, but we don't often hear it put that way.
Well, and we get remember that we screen what we hear, and there are particular filters that have given us partial information that gives us a skewed view of our world. So we say things like people act only out of self-interest, and yet there's tons of research showing that that's not the case. Right. One of the most interesting examples to me was reported just a couple days ago about how humpback whales save other species if they see that they're under attack.
Mm.
Now, that's not necessarily in their self-interest, but it's in a broader interest in terms of looking out for somebody else. Or you take another very large animal like the elephant that could just take care of itself, and yet if you see them in their natural habitat, they will do things like use their tusks to enlarge a spring so that the smaller animals from other species can get at the water more easily. There's lots and lots of examples of the ways
yes.
in which one species helps another.
Well, whales and elephants are certainly very high on the sort of awareness scale.
Mm-hmm.
We love them. We love them. So all of these words together, interconnectivity, participation, non-linearity, non-duality, interdependence, adaptability, cooperation, they really are, you sense that there is both a science component and there is a spiritual component. So you mm-hmm. talk a lot in the book about where these two meet. Are their arms around each other yet in your mind or in your perception?
Well, I think
sitting happily together.
It depends on, again, on where you're standing and your perspective. To me, we've had what's known as the ageless wisdom, which are the ancient teachings about what the world is all about, the nature of the cosmos, the purpose of life. And those, well, one of my friends calls those the woo-woo teachings. But if you start comparing those to what the science is telling us in quantum physics is saying, these are right on. This is what what the world is about. If you are coming at it if you're talking about spiritual from the perspective of understanding that we are working in a world of energy and that we have a responsibility of service in that context, that's one thing. If you're coming at it from a more traditional religious perspective, which says typically there is this entity, this God outside of ourselves who has said what we are supposed to do and is judging us or whatever, there you have a duality. That is not the reality that science affirms. Science affirms the first reality, that we are all part of what some people call one life, which is that huge cosmic energy field.
what I find interesting is that the ageless wisdom, we teach much from the ageless wisdom here at Spirit Fire. So I love that you bring that into the conversation. The ageless wisdom really gave birth to so many of the world's spiritual traditions. They can be traced back. And then it's, what have we done with those religions? What have we done in the name of those religions? And it seems that science is coming around now to sort of bring us all back to the sort of root again. You know, that's all we can ever do in our lives. We are given a certain amount of information. We try it on for size. We all have our limitations. We all have we've got our lessons to learn. We do what we will with what we've got. And from that experience, we grow. And so, you know, the ageless wisdom really did provide all that. And it seems like science is now coming around. We all seem to be so interested in science. We've seen the limitations of these sort of very isolated religious points of view that have not necessarily worked non-dualistically or for us all. And science is coming back and saying, hey, when we look at the ageless wisdom and its teachings, it's actually lining up quite nice. And it's sort of, I think it's softening and sort of, it's allowing a permeability within certain religious traditions and with certain individuals who adhere to religious traditions, and allowing them all to see their connection and what they've mm-hmm. got in common. And so I just want to also add that the School for Esoteric Studies, I know you are a very important member of the board there. I'm sure everybody's quite important on the board. It's a wonderful organization. I just want our listeners to know a little bit about that. Could you tell us, since we're talking about as science and theory and all of this comes together, a bit about your role there and all that the School of – not all, but what, some of what the School of Esoteric Studies can offer?
Sure. For those that are interested, the website is at esotericstudies.net. And the school is a bit different from some other organizations in that it is it's conceived of as a group project. In other words, all of us that are in the school, and I wouldn't say I'm more important than other members of the school, we are studying, but the purpose is to be able to be of service in the world in the most effective way that we can. And we know that there's a level of service which is individual, which is very important. You know, service is an expression of our being, of the fact that we are interconnected and that we treat each other, greet each other with respect. So we have individual service, but we also have group service and group work. Subjective group work is always has a kind of geometrically more powerful effect. And so one of the purposes of the School for Esoteric Studies is to train people in subjective group work and to facilitate and nourish group service in the world.
Beautiful. And I know that all of these words come into play within that organization and have so much to do with that word service. When we understand these principles that underlie our reality, or when we can embrace them and actually and live our lives by these principles, that is the service. That is our cosmic intention. We are then fulfilling our duty as a cosmic citizen. Would you say in our last minute?
Yes, and if I could say that one of the ways that the school is trying to do this, we have an initiative called Intergroup Collaboration to try to get people, spiritual groups, instead of competing with each other, to cooperate with each other.
Oh, beautiful.
And so if we think of ourselves as cosmic citizens, it's really a shift in awareness to really think of ourselves as part of this entire cosmos with the joys and the responsibilities that come with that.
Oh, beautifully put. Well, this has been such a great journey with you, Dorothy. We're out of time. I mean, the time just goes so fast. It's always a wonderful conversation. Listeners, the website is enoughforusall.com. Indeed, there is enough for us all. And Dr. Dorothy Riddle has done so much in her lifetime to see to it that we can at very least begin to understand the abundance that is available to us all. Dorothy, thank you so much for these three shows and for being such a very wonderful part of this round of meditations here at Spirit Fire. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve, for allowing me to be part of it.
And we hope to speak to you again. And Spirit Fire Radio, we will be back. Please check it out, spiritfireradio.com and Dr. Dorothy Riedel at enoughforusall.com. See you later.
Thank you for listening to Spirit Fire Radio. Tune in each Wednesday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, 12 noon Eastern, for your weekly guide to meditation and living with awareness. Join hosts Tim Darter and Steve Kramer and discover the ways that consciousness is being cultivated in everyday life. Connect to your day in a whole new way and find the amazing moments in life's routines that often pass us by. Add to your awareness with Spirit Fire Radio. To learn more about Spirit Fire, visit spiritfireradio.com.